It's a bit like living in Narnia, I guess. There's a difference between our world and the scriptural world. 6 days have passed in our world. We were last together here Monday night. Jesus was about to be born. And here we are on Sunday morning, and in scripture, 12 years have somehow passed. I think it's safe to say that this first Sunday of Christmas has some peculiarities to it. Now, I admit that I really have some great fondness for this Sunday because it always feels more relaxed than the ones immediately preceding it. Advent, of course, is about building dramatic tension until we reach the events around Jesus' birth. But today, the observance of Christmas Eve and Christmas Day have passed, and we are halfway through the season of Christmas. Christmas is, after all, 12 days long in the church world. Though for some of us, it probably does seem like we've been half-heartedly celebrating it for a couple of months. Anyway, this Sunday has got kind of a laid-back feel to me. But as I said, there are some peculiarities to it. Last year on this Sunday, our gospel reading was about the still baby Jesus being taken to the temple for purification. And that's where he and his family encounter the prophets Simeon and Anna. And I think that is a most uplifting passage. It's a good one for a post-Christmas Sunday. On the other hand, the year before, and again next year in our three-year cycle of readings, it was and will be the chilling story about the massacre of the babies in Bethlehem and the flight of the Holy Family to safety in Egypt. And that's just a bit jarring in the post-Christmas Day glow. And this year, we're about losing Jesus. Though that might not be too far off the thematic path for us as we dig our way out of holly and ivy and whatever it is we're to do with the turkey leftovers 6 days on. But it's not merely the subject matter. It's that chronological jump as well. Not that we can avoid this. There's just not a whole lot in the Bible about Jesus' childhood. Yes, we learn elsewhere that Jesus was circumcised and that he was taken to the temple for the aforementioned traditional purification rite, and that his family retreats to Egypt because of the threat to life and limb from the paranoid King Herod. But really, the sum total of all we find in the Bible about Jesus' childhood is our reading from Luke this morning. Just 11 verses. And by now, he's 12 years old, and babyhood is far behind him. Being that our childhood can shape our lives so powerfully, it would be rather illuminating to hear what Jesus' growing years were like. I know I'd like to know more, but there's just really not much for us. There are some other stories in some other later non-biblical writings that could have some truth to them, though it's wise to be a bit wary of those stories because the character of the Jesus we meet in those stories seems at odds with the character of the Jesus we meet in the four Gospels, so their reliability is a bit suspect. It's probably safe to assume that Jesus would have had the normal upbringing for a child in Galilee. His parents seem to be quite devout, and so it makes some sense that he underwent the normal religious education for people who took their faith seriously. And he probably did whatever it was that normal kids did in that time and place. But as I said, these verses we heard are really all we've got in the Bible that tell us anything about Jesus' childhood, which I should act would officially end the following year, when he turned 13 and presumably had his bar mitzvah, that coming of age ceremony. It's worth remembering that the phenomenon that we call the teenage years is a fairly recent thing, maybe just 150 years or so old in Canada. Prior to that, you were a child, and then at some point, you were an adult. A young one, agreed, but in most places, in most times and cultures, you didn't have this protracted period of being neither fish nor fowl developmentally. You're not a child, but you're not yet an adult. No, in most places, you were one, and then one day or another. On the other hand, the process of maturation does require that we move through certain stages of development. And in this story we heard today, Jesus is still officially a child, but he does seem to be revealing some of the independence that comes with moving into adulthood. The story itself isn't an uncommon one, at least not in my experience or my capacity as a negligent parent. I mean, have you ever lost your own or someone else's kids? Come on, adults. Come on. Own up. I think most of us have done this, usually by accident, of course. Mostly. Depending. I remember being in the bay in Nanaimo with my son Connell when he was about 4 years old. I was wandering around the store with him, and then suddenly he was gone. And I remember, to this day, I still remember trying to remain as calm as possible as I initially looked for him. And then the rising panic as the minutes, no, actually they were really just seconds passed. And I remember getting on the floor looking for him on the ground level because he wasn't tall enough to be seen over the clothes racks. Of course, visions of kidnapping, slavery, inhuman medical experiments by abducting aliens, and a lonely death assailed me as I pretended to be calm. To borrow from Mary's words, I searched for him with great anxiety. Eventually, he wandered into view unharmed and, from what I could see, quite unconcerned. And I remember being furious at him for my lapse in parental supervision. It's a scary thing to misplace a child in any time or place. I suspect it's probably worse today in the age of helicopter parenting. Of course, when I was growing up, okay, here we go. When I was growing up, for some reason, my parents seemed to be far less concerned about the surely no less dangerous world that I lived in. I remember I was 7 years old and living in Kelowna, about the size of Parksville today. And I remember my mom packing me a lunch and sending me off to the beach with my friends for the day. The beach. I was seven. With friends. I don't think any of us could yet swim. I know I certainly couldn't. There were no lifeguards on most of the beaches along the lakefront. And mom didn't even know for certain which of those beaches I was going to. But hey, what could possibly go wrong? The answer was nothing. Oh, there was that one little near drowning thing I experienced. Yeah. But other than that, it all worked out pretty well. A few years ago, I got talking with someone I met at a mutual friend's birthday party, and we got to regaling one another about stories from our youth, and it was one of those, you know, if you think you had it bad, let me tell you about the time, one of those kind of conversations that I know I occasionally get into. I think it's fair to say that he, like, just won the prize, like, going away. He told me about a time, he was in his early teens, and he was playing for a softball team that had a chance to play in a tournament in the South Okanagan. But being that they didn't have the resources to get the team all the way to Penticton, the coach of the team had a better idea. It was this. Are you ready? He got the team to hitchhike from Vancouver Island to Penticton. Like on the ferry, you know? Like, seriously. Hey, but look, it's not like the coach wasn't safety conscious, because he did get them to hitchhike in pairs. Because, you know, like, you can't be too careful. Things seem a bit different those years ago, just despite the probably exactly the same dangers that we face today. Well, most families would likely only be able to logistically make one. The travel was a big commitment to make. those 3 times a year pilgrimages to Jerusalem would be really important features in the cycle of religious life in Mary and Joseph's time. The faithful would travel to the capital for the Feast of Tabernacles and for the celebration of Pentecost, and as we heard in our Bible reading this morning, for the observance of Passover. The rule at the time was that it was the men who were actually required to do the trip. And so the fact that Mary was there for this yearly journey, and we're told they went every year, it suggests this is a family that were deeply devoted. These were people who didn't just do Christmas and Easter. No, these were those seriously religious, fanatical kinds of people who would actually turn up on the first Sunday after Christmas. And don't forget, this was a significant trek for someone living in Nazareth. It was 3 days of travel, and you would usually have to go in a good-sized group just for safety reasons. This was no last-minute, hey, why don't we go to Christmas Eve service at St. Stephen's kind of thing. This was planned well ahead. It was a major undertaking. They make the trip to Jerusalem, and after the Passover celebration, the family heads back home. And about a day out of Jerusalem, Mary and Joseph look around and they realize that Jesus, like, isn't with them. And that's not just embarrassing. It's like panic stations. I mean, how did this happen? Well, strangely enough, I think I get it. They're traveling with a crowd of people. Many of them relatives, lots of good friends. And Jesus, he's a good kid and he's responsible. And hey, he's 12, he's nearly a man. One of the things that we have done on the Mexico mission trips when we're traveling and when we're there is we do a lot of counting. We're counting constantly. Just get the magic number, usually some multiple of 15 or 30 or 45. And so we just go around the room. We just count. We got everybody. We're looking for faces, just bodies. In part, we count because we don't all know each other that well, at least before we leave. We know each other too well when we get home. But faces and personalities are less ingrained in us, so all we do is we count. Traveling with a large number of people who know each other well can be quite a different exercise because you're seeing familiar faces, and somehow familiarity makes it easier to miss people. Oh, I'm sure he's here. I'm sure I saw him because he's always there. I can easily see how they lost track of Jesus. And then in horror and surely with some burden of guilt, they went charging back to what suddenly seemed like an especially dangerous Jerusalem. I mean, these were country people. And they knew that Jerusalem, well, yes, sure, it is the place that housed the temple, this holy place. It was also a big city. And you all know what big cities are like. I was thinking about that this week. I mean, for example, you folks from French Creek, you probably experience the same thing when you risk a trip into this debauched Gomorrah by the sea, Qualicum. Joseph and Mary, they were terrified. And so they left the safety of their crowd of traveling companions. They race back and they begin searching. And by the time they find Jesus, he's been out of sight for 3 days. A number that will come up again. And they find him in the temple. He's sitting with the priests and the scholars, and they're having a theological conversation. And it's clear to everyone that this child, this not quite a man, he's something special. You can just hear the conversation amongst the religious elite after his puzzled but relieved parents have retrieved him and are once again heading back to Nazareth. You know, Mordecai, this kid, he's got something. I can't quite put my finger on it, but he's got something. Have you ever heard it put quite the way he explained it? Put your money on it. We'll be hearing about him again. There's a lot going on in this story. It's theologically rich, and honestly, it's a bit of a preacher's dream. But it's also the first, and this year the only Sunday after Christmas. And as noted earlier, today's got a certain relaxed feeling to it. mean, many of us here are still recovering from the frantic nature of the holiday. We're still doing the laundry after the kids have left. We're trying to figure out how long to leave the tree up. We've only got one service going this morning. We're batting cleanup on all the Christmas carols. And so we're trying to keep things as simple as we can today. And so in that spirit, let me just leave you with a question. And it's just a modest one. You ever lost Jesus? I mean, have you ever misplaced Jesus? Because it's sure easy to do. I struggle with losing him with startling and embarrassing regularity. You know, like we're together, I'm focused on him, things are good, and some time passes and I get focused on some other important and truly pressing matter, and I look around and I stop to do a head count and he's not there. It's not that I meant to lose him, but things got a bit busy and complicated and there was stuff that demanded my attention, and so instead of keeping my eye on him, instead of following him, I left without him. I wandered off and suddenly I was out of sight. It's easy enough to lose Jesus, I find. To follow the one who repeatedly asks his disciples, "Follow me," requires keeping an eye on him. Experience suggests to me that assuming that I actually know where he's going is a bit foolish, because he's surprising. So I need to keep looking to him. I need to keep looking for him. His direction changes. Happens with denominations too, this losing Jesus thing. Check to see which is really more influential. Ideology or politics or rules or ethics. This is true across the board from conservative to liberal churches. Is it those things? Or is it the upside down world of the kingdom in which Jesus is king? Because he'll pretty much always call into question politics and ideology and rules eventually. He's easy to misplace. And when rules or ethics become shorthand for following, you can just about guarantee you're going to misplace him. Happens to local churches too. We get really busy, and often with really good and important stuff. We get focused on some concern, some anxiety, you know, like a difficult decision or money. Oh, finances are a regular one in churches. And of course, it's an issue in times of change. I'll not forget our opening interview with the consultant Paul Miller. We were trying to figure out if he was a fit to help us with some of the transition work that the congregation's needing to be about over the next year. So we had a Skype call in the hall downstairs. Church board on this end, Paul in the other. And the conversation began with our board chair, Dave Ney, asking with a bit of a wink, but still as a real question, asking if Paul had any concerns about Jesus, because we were rather taken with him here. Remember, that's what he asked. That was Dave's first question, and it's a darn good question. Paul, to his credit, he laughed. And he agreed that indeed he had a certain soft spot for Jesus too. And so I think we got off on the right foot. It's like we were doing the head count. Are we all here? But having been around congregations in transition before, I can tell you it's easy enough to move on without him. It's surprisingly easy to lose Jesus. You ever do that? Ever leave him behind? Ever misplace Jesus? So, one last time until next year. Merry Christmas. Amen.